Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good afternoon and welcome to Straight from the Source, coming to you from the studios of Heritage Radio Network here in beautiful downtown Bushwick, Brooklyn, New York. My name is Clay Gordon. I am the creator and moderator of thechocolatelife.com and author of the IACP award-winning book, Discover Chocolate. And this afternoon, we're going to be talking chocolate and cocoa, and specifically an ethical supply chain with the executive director or co-executive director of Equal Exchange, Rob Everts. Rob, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Clay.
And you're in Boston. It's freezing here. How is it there? I wish that I could be just sort of curled up around a mug of nice hot chocolate today.
That would be kind of nice. It's a winter thing, isn't it? And it's a winter day here. We're actually getting winter this year, unlike last year.
It is quite remarkable. I was down in Peru a couple of weeks ago and very, very sad to come back. You know, I've been doing a little bit of research on Equal Exchange and the history of the fair trade movement, and I was shocked to discover that Equal Exchange actually started importing what you might think of as fairly traded coffee out of Nicaragua before the establishment of the Max Avalar Initiative in Belgium by almost 2 years. I mean, so to some extent, you know, Equal Exchange has really been at the forefront and pioneer of what we can think of as the fair trade movement.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. I've been here 16, 17 years, but in fact, it was started by three guys who were very active and immersed in the food co-op movement in New England, and they wanted to know where stuff was coming from. Consumers wanted to know. They had no clue. We as Americans, as you would know, are generally pretty disconnected from where our food comes from. So they wanted to connect farmers and consumers where possible, literally, but certainly spiritually. And so they jumped off the proverbial cliff, formed a startup, later became Equal Exchange, and in fact, it was 1986 when we imported our first container of coffee, and it was a very overtly political act. It was a challenge to Ronald Reagan's embargo on the Nicaragua Sandinista government, and we found a loophole that enabled us to bring in coffee at the time, which is our first product, in a direct challenge to that embargo. And then and over time, this was before free trade had even entered really the American dialogue. So we were talking about fair trade, and it was definitely an idea ahead of its time, but its time is now, and people are tuning into where things are coming from.
No, absolutely. And I'm looking at what I think of as another sort of overt challenge, if you will, is that I notice nowhere on your website do I see a fair trade certified logo. So yeah. What's that all about? I mean, there's a bunch of politics within the fair trade movement, and we can get to them in a little while, if you will. But, you know, even though you talk about dealing with fairly traded product, when we think about fair trade, FLO, Fair Trade Labeling Organization, I don't see the fair trade symbol anywhere.
Yeah, you'll see some symbols and some stuff on our products, but we generally don't we don't lead with it because Equal Exchange, as you pointed out, began doing this before the standards were even formally set, and frankly, 10 years or 12 years before the United States had a call it a franchise within the International Fair Trade Certification Scheme. So we've been more about putting out our worldview, our goal of establishing access for small farmers in the market against all odds in a world of behemoths, and then leading with small farmers. And you will find stuff about fair trade all over the place, but you may not find that a seal on the website.
Well, let's talk about access to markets, and because one of the things that's supposed to happen is that, of course, farmers are supposed to get paid more for what they produce. But it turns out that a co-op might produce, let's say, 100 tons of something. And they're required to pay the certification fees on all 100 tons, but they may only be able to find a fair trade certified buyer for, let's say, 20 to 25 tons of that. It sounds like there's a real difficulty in getting access to markets.
The access is real, and it's still a matter of, I think, demand on our end, on the consumer side, and that's why we've put from the very beginning such a high premium on organizing and educating consumers to be able to actually imagine choosing brand A over brand B and having an option, because it's true that whereas there's nearly a thousand farmer co-ops that are in the fair trade system, very few are able to place most of their product into the system on fair trade terms, and so it's a constant battle, and I think it's a lot of though is our job here to engage consumers over those choices and to make options viably available.
Well, what do you think the impediment is? If the perception is that fair trade delivers this value to the farmers, and consumers are looking for this connection to the source, where do you think the impediment is coming from to making that breakthrough? And being able to place 100% of things that are produced on fair trade terms sold into the market on fair trade terms.
Yeah, there's education, there's demographics, there's income, there's quality. Like, even just think about quality for a second. We have to be as hardcore on quality as someone who is not. Right, because no one's going to buy fair trade stuff purely out of solidarity to small farmers if it doesn't taste good. So, like that's—I don't want to go down that path right now. But that's an element to it, and we need to compete there as well. I think for people who are large conglomerates, they're able to just have more leverage with farmers and keep prices lower. And consumers, people do, no matter what we might say, people tend to look for the lowest price on things. Yes, value. Yes, there's niches. Yes, there's organic consumers. But there's a real market pressure of internalizing it. I guess I'd say what we try to do in fair trade, and no system is perfect, God knows we're not, is to internalize the externalities, right, that the phrase the economists would use when you just slough off, poverty wages or prices, mm-hmm. and environmental contamination, all that kind of stuff. We try to build that into the price structure, and it's a challenge.
Yeah. Do you think that the fact that if you look at any of the social and fair trade initiatives, that actually none of them really have an emphasis on improving quality, and all of them put their benchmark prices based on, mark to market, whatever the world market is doing plus a little bit, without sort of recognizing that the market economy in Peru is different from the market economy in Dominican Republic, and the fact that we're paying the same price and paying the same premium and rewarding the same things doesn't make much sense at all.
No, that's right. The system has gone down that path in the past. Like, hey, the cost of growing coffee in West Africa is going to be less than in Peru, and so should that minimum price plus the fair trade premium and such be the same? And it was actually producers, when this was most formally visited several years ago, determined they didn't want to change that to kind of customize by country, and actual production costs and stuff, because they feared that buyers would disproportionately make a beeline to
the cheaper
stuff
countries.
They could call fair trade to the cheaper stuff. But it is a challenge, and let's go ahead and call it a contradiction. Yeah.
Oh man, it's sort of the law of unintended consequences. You know, you're sitting here, you're working, you try to do stuff, and then you know somebody's going to game the system and create a loophole somewhere, and you go, oh my gosh, of course, you know, why didn't we think of that already? Okay, so you know, one of the things I also learned in doing the research is that, and this is something that I think is a common misconception about fair trade, is that people think that the money that they spend in the extra price that they pay in the grocery store or wherever they're buying actually gets paid to the farmer, right? And as a matter of fact, there's usually in the conventional FLM model a disconnect. And I just realized something, which is that. The fair trade price gets paid to whatever is called the exporting organization, and that might not be the cooperative.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So, yeah, go ahead.
No. I'm just, you know, so, you know, one of the challenges, you know, for an organization, I suppose, like Equal Exchange, because you're trying to sit outside the model and be more responsive and be more responsible and transparent, you know, is how do you actually make sure that the monies that you paid get distributed to the people who have done the work?
Yeah. We, at the most macro level, were able to do that because we know the cost of certification. We know the dollar value of a premium, you know, that's going to go like on a container of cacao or something like that. And so I'm not sure we actually do know in every case, in a chocolate bar, in a retail setting, whatever, a different brand, a different size, that it's not passed down the way you say. I would actually say more often than not it is, but I believe we have a paper trail. Here's the price, here's the volume, et cetera, et cetera. We talk to farmers about what the cost of production is, and I think, like you said, sometimes the exporter isn't the cooperative. Like, again, all payments in our system go to the cooperative, not to an individual farmer, and it's up to them to decide how they want those extra prices to go. And generally, it's well accepted. Sometimes, you know, it's controversial, but that's the system, and it's part of the democracy that's built into this. And one last thing on this. A lot of what we've been doing for 26 years has been attempting to build viable and sustainable small farmer supply chains. And one key element that you see on the most successful and mature co-ops now many years in is they do control their export. And I know this is not the case with many still, absolutely not. But it's been a remarkable growth and maturation process where people didn't even used to have their own beneficio, like a coffee or a cocoa processing plant. Now many more own their own processing plants. Many more are their own export agents, and it's a slow slog.
Well, I can tell you that may be true in some commodities, but it's certainly not the case in cocoa. I mean, if you look at cocoa in Ghana, there's like one certified co-op, Coop Cocoa, and it's a special dispensation. The reason why there's only one is that everything gets sold through the government cooperative, and there's an immediate 30% discount over, you know, whatever price gets paid.
Yeah.
That the government takes off the top. But let's walk us through in a little bit. I've been to the cooperative in Belize, the Toledo Cacao Growers Association. We're lucky enough to visit there when Gregor Hargrove from Green and Blacks was still working there, but was most recently at Cocabo down in Panama.
Yeah.
And saw what it's going there. So Cocabo, you see the farmers, they bring in their cocoa. It's graded, it's sorted, it's weighed. They give a little chit, and they're paid an amount of money. And that is an internal amount of money that the co-op decides that it's buying cocoa for today. Right? And then they turn around. Then they turn around and they offer it for sale. Now there may be standing contracts, perhaps with companies like Equal Exchange. But when you go and purchase the cocoa, it goes across the border from Panama to Puerto Limon in Costa Rica. You're managing the logistics of that transport. You're working with, you know, a larger brokerage or firm like Ecom Atlantic or something like that to handle the logistics of getting it from there to wherever your chocolate factory is?
Yeah. For us, whereas we import about 7 million pounds of green coffee every year, all of it direct from farmer cooperatives, like these secondary centrales, you know, the secondary cooperatives. We bring it here. We roast the coffee. We package it. We sell it under our brand, completely vertically integrated. We're newer into the game of cacao and chocolate and sugar. And so we have not established our own chocolate factory here at this time because we don't have any reason to believe we could do that successfully yet at this point of our chocolate development.
It's very difficult to do well, that's for sure.
It's difficult to do well, and we don't want to fall on our face doing it, although that remains the goal to do, because controlling that supply chain is just more advantageous to everyone, I think everyone involved. So we do have our stuff literally purchased, the cacao, like from Cocabo, for example, as an example, by a company that participates very deeply in fair trade in Switzerland, and they take care of the roasting and the grinding and the later the, you know, the conching and the molding and the scent, and we receive a finished product. We go down and spend time each year, maybe more than once, with the cooperatives in Panama. I was at Cocabo also last year, in Peru, Ecuador. We have that kind of relationship, but our ideal is what we've been able to establish in coffee, and that's the direct trade relationship, and we're not there yet in chocolate.
Well, we're going to come back after the break, and we're going to discuss some of those issues and some of the developments and the possibilities. My guest today, Rob Everts from Equal Exchange. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a minute.
You are listening to All of the Time by Controller on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery. In our industrial world, most wines have become brands, but the wines I love are so much more. Fine wine is a civilizing substance that connects us to nature. It cannot be stamped out in a factory. If you're listening to this great show, you probably eat different. I urge you to drink different too. Go deeper. Cane5.com.
Hey, we're back with Rob Everts of Equal Exchange here on Straight for the Source. My name is Clay Gordon. So I think that's straight from the source, not straight for the source, but I like that. I like that idea. So you know, there is, you know, people like me are sometimes a little skeptical. I mean, I've been down, I've seen, you know, what goes on in the co-ops. I talk to people, see some of the direct trade and other sort of models. And to some extent, there's a sort of institutionalized acceptance of a fair trade that makes it very, very difficult to criticize what it is that's going on. And in part because of this, you know, understanding, you know, where does the money go? I noticed that one of the things you talk about, Equal Exchange, is that you do practice open book accounting, and you practice open book accounting with your staff. But do you also do that with your suppliers? Let them know where the money is going.
When they ask, yeah, we do. We also publish our annual reports in Spanish, and we share, like, here's our basic bottom line. We get into not every meeting, every place, every whatever, but yeah, we are there because it's the mind job it does on a campesino who sees that you are selling something like a chocolate bar for $4 in the market. It's almost unimaginable to them that is the price that someone pays for that, when they realize relatively how little they get. So we do try to, yeah, absolutely share. We talk about our margins. We talk about what is fair, what's operable. We talk about we could pay higher prices, but the honest trade-off in lower volumes.
Right.
And, you know, we all pay way above the fair trade price all the time right now, but I'm not even going to say it's a fair price what we pay.
Well,
you know what I mean?
Again, if what we're doing is we're not actually staking the price that gets paid to an understanding of local economic conditions. It's just, hey, here's what the commodity price is, and, you know, it's a monopsony, and there are six buyers who control 80% of the world's production, so they effectively get to control the prices. So, you know, basing the premium on top of, you know, the commodity prices, there's no incentive really to understand what the actual cost of production is in any one of these commodities that's traded.
Yeah, I mean, there definitely have been studies, you know, by all sorts of people on the cost of production, and we, in discussions, believe we are significantly exceeding that in the prices we pay. Is it felt equally across, let's say, a co-op of 150 members who are only able to place 30% of their stuff to fair traders and the rest on the market? That's where it gets really challenging to quantify some of this stuff. But I think maybe at the most macro level, if you take the vantage point of producers, do they find it a worthwhile investment? The cost of certification, the prices they get, and I think the answer is they overwhelmingly do. I mean, the list of co-ops that have sought and obtained certification has grown every year for 25 years. And so they see these other elements of infrastructure by banding together, and even co-ops. We're a co-op. We're not perfect. You know, we're made up of human beings, but people see these additional things beyond pure price, right? Access to financing sometimes, access to organic certification, those kind of things that you can't necessarily achieve on your own as a really small-scale farmer.
That's certainly very true, and you know, one of the emphases on growing the cooperative movement is certainly a hallmark of fair trade. But if you actually look at it, you know, in the cocoa world, in the chocolate world, because you know that's my area of specialization, there are only 55 fair trade certified co-ops in the world. And again, you know, now is the reason why there aren't more. Is because only 25% of the product is currently being sold, and only 25% of the cocoa that is certified, certifiable, is being sold as certified. And so there's a glut of cocoa on the market, and people are going, you know, I'm going to do all this work, and I'm not going to get any return for it.
Yeah. Right?
But, you know, it's been successful in coffee. It's been successful in bananas. It's been successful in a couple of other places. Cocoa, not so much. I mean, do you have any, you know, thoughts on why? What's special or different about cocoa?
I think, like, it is an industry dominated. I suppose you could say coffee is too, right? By a handful of
bananas,
giant,
but you know, only a couple of banana companies when you think about it.
Yeah. See, this is what we're up against. We're attempting to inject some shred of equity into this system. It is overwhelming at that level. There's other challenges too. When you look at the trade-offs to growing and cultivating organically versus with chemicals, the yields are much lower. Mm-hmm. And does the organic premium that farmers get through the market, does it compensate for the corresponding reduction in yield per hectare? And it's often it doesn't, and so it's the job of people like us to go beyond kind of the baseline definitions of fair trade and work on soil improvement and getting the right, you know, varietals in there, and shade management and all those things. You were at Cocabo in Panama. I mean, it is wet down there. It is rain. There's a lot of fungus and mold and stuff. It's like all those things, you know, are in the mix of challenges for farmers.
No, and you know, again, doing a little bit of the math on fair trade, you know, the average yield across all cooperatives in the system is only 820 kilos per hectare, which is extremely low.
It's low.
It's very, very low. In some locations, you know, you're getting 2,000-3,000 kilos a hectare. It's fairly low. So you mentioned that Equal Exchange itself is modeled on a cooperative basis, and I noticed the URL is equalexchange.coop.
Yeah.
Which is very, very cool. So what does the cooperative model of governance mean for you and how you are able to assist the producers that you're working with? And why don't we call them farmers? Because they are farmers, yeah. They're not producers.
Yeah, yeah, farmers. It's a powerful part of who we are. And at one level that people might not think of, we know that there is inefficiency in democracy. Like that, this helps us relate at a pretty visceral level to farmer cooperatives. Like there is not merely a top dog here who says, "Listen up." It's not that we all sit around and 100 worker owners, you know, participate in consensus decisions or anything, but rather there is literal ownership. It is one worker, one vote. After you've worked here for 1 year, you become a member of the cooperative. It's the great equalizer. Everyone, if there's profit at the end of the year, a subset of that is divided up per capita to each person. So we share that. We elect our own board of directors. The board is six of us, worker owners, plus three outsiders for perspective, so it retains worker control. But the point is, there's a lot of discussion and debate about many decisions at many levels, and we can see why a farmer co-op would have that type of inefficiency working against them versus like a one large scale grower.
You know, it certainly is a problem. You know, there's a big cooperative down in Bolivia, Fairtrade, but there's no professional management. It's reelected every 2 years and 100% changeover. I mean, one of the things that I've seen in some of the cooperative models. I was just in Pura at Sepi Cafe, which is a cooperative of cooperatives, and as a matter of fact, there's a cooperative above it. So when you talk about multi-tier cooperatives. So there are a bunch of small producers that are, Norandino, but you know, all the small ones, you know, in and around Chulucanas, a very, very strong model because one of the things that it's done is it's been able to establish a group which has continuity, it has good management skills. They're able to take on projects which are longer than the two-year development cycle or the two-year election cycle. And, you know, one of the things that most people don't know about Peru is that a lot of the cooperative structure down there is actually funded by the U.S. taxpayer as part of a method, part of a program is to keep the farmers from going coca, which would be the process.
Exactly.
So,
now, I'm glad you mentioned Sepi Cafe. I know we are approaching the end of the half hour, but Sepi Cafe is a real success story. We know them through coffee. We haven't yet bought cacao from them, but we were their first guinea pig buyer in the United States. We took the risk and bought the first container that Sepi Cafe of coffee exported to the U.S., and we've been with them for like 17 years, and with strong leadership on their end, the combination of institution to institution, co-op to co-op, as well as obviously establishing other buyers as well, has led them to be a real force in the northern part of Peru, as you know.
No, it's really fabulous. And having just got down there, you want to go down there as soon as you can and see if you can negotiate for some of their cocoa because somebody's going in there and looking to wants to buy 100% of the production, which would not be good for anybody. But Sepi Cafe, they've been around for 17 years. They've started cocoa 6 years ago. They've gone to 60 metric tons of production in 6 years. They want to double in two more years. They wanted to get to 1,000 tons within 5 to 7. I mean, it's
incredible.
A pretty spectacular success story in that particular way.
Yes, it is.
Okay. So, we're gonna take the last couple of minutes as we head out of this. I notice looking at the story on your website, equalexchange.coop, that you did in fact become fair trade and social certified in 2010 under a program called IMO Fair for Life.
Yeah.
So what was it about, I mean, because, you know, the co-op has been around for a long time. What was it about IMO's approach to this that said, yes, this is the organization that we want to get our certification from?
Yeah, I think it was more in response to where we saw our prior certifier going, which had a lot of policies and approaches that we disagreed with.
Now you're talking about Fairtrade USA.
Fairtrade USA.
And specifically the issue about certifying small producer organizations as opposed to hired labor organizations or haciendas and things like that.
Yeah, the plantations. It just felt like No one would argue that migrant workers on these plantations are among the most exploited in the world. I worked for the United Farm Workers Union for like 8 years, many years ago here, and I could see that. But the point is, we don't believe that fair trade is the answer for those settings. Those plantation owners have access to the market. This scheme is about getting small-scale farmers access to the market. And so one of the reasons we went to EMO was that they merely certify. They don't enter into that contradictory area of marketing at the same time where you can't fairly promote all of your licensees. They merely come and do their thing and go, whereas Fairtrade USA tries to work on both sides of that coin. They do the certification, but they devote a lot of your fees and resources to marketing and promotion and, you know, naming brands and unequally and things like that. So there was a lot there.
Right. So is FTUSA not using Flow Cert as their certifier? I mean, they're doing it themselves?
Say that again.
The Fair Trade Labeling Organizations in 2004 or something like that, or 2002, were basically split up into the labeling and marketing part of it and then the certification part of it.
That was really important. It was the same contradiction there. Yeah. So they are legally different entities, Flow Cert and Flow International,
And this is a nuance that maybe I didn't pick up, but Fairtrade USA is combining both activities under the same umbrella? Or are they using an external certifier still?
I think they're in a transition of who they're going to have do the actual certification. They may have resolved that, but I'm not even sure who it is. If it's them or
But again, one of these really subtle, you know, really interesting nuances having to do with favoritism, who it is you're going to promote. Are you certifying and licensing and labeling at the same time? And what are sort of the inherent conflicts that are going on there? It's a real minefield is the way to think about it. You step in it and all of a sudden you realize it's a lot more complicated than you thought it was.
Exactly, and these things absolutely deserve scrutiny. Like I said at the outset, people are just dangerously disconnected from where our stuff comes. We want to get challenged. I'm glad you're asking these kind of questions, and I'm glad you're doing your blog. I wish more consumers would challenge, like, why should I believe you? Thank you for asking. Because no system is perfect.
Right.
No, fair trade is not the magic bullet. It is a building block along the way to build economic justice into the marketplace, and we're trying to do our part to help build that road.
Well, Rob, you've been a fabulous guest today. I really appreciate your coming on. One of the things I would like to talk about at some future point, if you're interested in coming back, I didn't beat you up too badly today, was the fact that one of the things that Equal Exchange has been pioneering is the kind of benefits which are afforded to farmers in developing countries to the American farmer, which is completely overlooked in this dialogue. I mean, why are these systems, you know, only available there when, you know, if you look at, you know, people like Robin Romano, who did the film La Cosecha, The Harvest, looking at the fate of migrant farm workers, or the plight, if you will, of migrant farm workers in the United States. I mean, you know, we're not blameless here as well.
Right.
You know, there's a great deal going on. So hopefully we'll have a chance to get back in this discussion and talk about what Equal Exchange USA, Equal Exchange is doing for farmers here in the United States. But as I say, thanks. You have a fabulous guest and look forward to talking to you soon. And I also have to thank Jack Inslee, my engineer for today's program, to the people at Heritage Radio Network and Heritage Foods for making it possible for me to be here. I'm a member. I urge everybody to become a member of Heritage Radio Network and support the great work that's being done. Why don't you also take the opportunity to go to iTunes, subscribe to the podcast, go and visit heritageradionetwork.org, find my page Straight from the Source, and you can download and listen to any one of the several thousand other programs that are available. So thanks again this afternoon for being here, and as always, thanks again for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.